My name is Vladimir Goldstein. I am a professor of Slavic studies at Brown University, which is, like one of the finest universities in the country. And we are getting ready to the semester. I see already students are back, and most of the professors are back. Professors are usually behind the students getting back. August is a very funny month, especially within Russian cultural tradition. Russians are totally obsessed with August, starting with the kind of all these events. There was like when Soviet Union was collapsing, there was in August attempt to overthrow the government of Yeltsin. There was this what they call Gorbachev, whatever, this the state committee which wanted to overthrow these reformers. Then there was, I think, the submarine boat sank Kursk. Then there was in August attacks in Moscow when the Islamic terrorists took over the theater and Russian responded to that in a dramatic way. Then there was attacks in some school in Ossetia. So you read Russian news and they say what this August will bring. So people are already nervous and full, and they obviously have some time on their hands because it's still summer vacation. So once this plane with Radcliffe landed in Moscow, rumor mill started again. What will this August event bring? And there is tons of rumors which we can probably discuss because
Yeah,
no
well,
one
look,
knows.
let's start by just a very simple question. Do you think it was initiated from Moscow or Washington?
I think it was initiated from Washington because obviously Trump is reaching out, and he has so many fights nowadays at his hands. The recent one being one with Canada and many other kind of problems, which he instead of solving, he's actually exacerbates. So I suspect whether he hopes to get something, with Russia on kind of on his side. Maybe, we can talk about whether, but obviously it's come from him because, a heightened tension on the in Eastern Europe is the last thing he needs because there is probably burning points all over the world now. So
Yeah, but do
that's.
you think that that Putin and the Russians think that Donald Trump is genuine about trying to solve the Ukraine crisis? Because there's a lot of commentators around the world now that are saying, well, this was just a bit of electioneering. And actually, although he's saying a lot of nice words, he's rather happy that the British and other Europeans are, killing Russians, destroying Russian infrastructure.
I think he's actually probably is not 100% happy. He's happy in terms of, he is some kind of a businessman or thinks like businessman. I don't know how successful a businessman he is, but he thinks like businessman. So if he thinks that American industry can make money by selling military weaponry to Ukraine, fine. Whether he kind of gets some cheap stuff, land or resources from Ukraine is fine, but he does want like very very big kind of explosion of violence, increased tension because recently, at least last kind of 40 days, Ukrainians were trying to show and manifest to Europeans that they're actually succeeding and thus getting more help under the pretext that they're succeeding. Obviously, they're not. So now we're at this moment, precisely in August, as Putin called it, Ukrainians opened the Pandora box. So now they have to deal with it. So Russia increased the attack. So the whole thing can get out of sort of control, and that's the last thing Trump needs.
Well,
He's
look,
also,
from your Slavic point of view, what do you think's actually at the root of this conflict?
Russian and Ukrainian.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
I think it's basically it's kind of history and tradition, and I think Russians get used. People say that military always fights last battles. So for Russians, starting kind of the Second World War and this the Stalin doctrine, they need kind of a buffer zone between themselves and the West. And Ukraine, with the Eastern European going kind of the other way, European Ukraine was seen as this buffer zone. So when NATO forces and Europeans began sort of to move very actively toward Ukraine and making all kind of propositions to Ukraine, and Ukraine was acting up, they are ready to accept it. For Russians to have NATO in Ukraine was a total red line. So they've been warning, they've been alerting, they've been saying, and it was also connected with the Russian Black Sea fleet in Crimea. So basically, it was absolutely obvious to anyone that not necessarily Putin, Russian establishment would respond. And Putin just heard it and he responded. How clever he responded, how ready he was for that, that's a different issue. But it was inevitable that Russians wouldn't tolerate NATO in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, we even here had Nigel Farage, in the from the Reform Party, which is a sort of insurgent nationalist party here in the UK, saying during the general election campaign 2 years ago, well, we provoked the Russians to invade, which was quite an extraordinary thing to say. He got lots of flak from it. But anyway, look, let's get back to this Ratcliffe trip to Moscow. Given that you
Okay.
think it was probably an American inspired visit, what do you think they may have been talking about? And was it just to do with Ukraine, or do you think the Middle East would have been talked about too?
I'm sure Middle East was very, very important there because whether one kind of likes it or not, Russians are still a very major player. They're not player on the level of Soviet Union when there was like, two big opposing parties, but they are still, very, very major player. So, obviously Trump, as I was saying in the beginning, he's not in the position to lose, Russia completely, because Russia still can pull a lot of strings in Iran, in Israel, in many other places. So he maybe when Putin said that the West or Ukraine in particular opening Pandora box, one should take it kind of seriously. The simplistic reason was some Russian commentator says that there was a threat actually to Great Britain, that Russians were not happy with the recent trip of Burnham to Kyiv, where he said he's going to give blueprints for this Storm Shadow weaponry and so on. So there were talks of some people that we should hit, Ukraine, not Ukraine, in Great Britain. And, that was kind of superficial. But I think it's not. I don't think Americans are worried about Russian nuclear attack on Britain. I don't think it's in the works, not yet at least.
Well,
But I
no,
think.
not nuclear, but obviously the Russians are getting pretty fed up. Just on the motorway, the M4 from Bristol to London, just to the west of that, halfway to London, is a city called Swindon, which is manufacturing what we hear. There are several factories there manufacturing drones. I wonder whether, because of the electoral pressures on Putin, whether there is actually increasing pressure for him to stop the flow of drones and to hit the source.
That's absolutely true. I hear it, loud and clear from my friends in Russia that people are very much frustrated. That people, even the sort of people who, like, even last year were very much pro kind of core government course, now they say that the government is failing to protect them, failing to finish this war, which is getting increasingly unpopular. So he definitely, there's a decision to sort of escalate. I don't think Russians have other ways at their disposals. Maybe they can attack, ports where Brits deliver their goods. I don't think they're quite ready to start attacking one way or another Great Britain. But at least there is a threat of escalation in terms of more strikes in more central places, from Kyiv to the command centers, to ports, to anything. And there is a threat of escalation now in Iran. And whether one likes it or not, Russians still have probably 20, about 25% of Israeli population, Russian speaking, mostly Jews, many of them not Jews, but mostly Jews. So Russians still have a very powerful kind of player in Middle East between the Russian sort of position of popularity with certain Arab countries, but also rather sort of good connections between Putin and Netanyahu. So I think Russians can do, from perspective of America, mischief in Israel, in Middle East. They also can increase their help to Iran and so on. So Trump made a very reasonable desire to de-escalate. There was a certain moment people were talking that both Ukraine and Trump suggest let's escalate in order to de-escalate later. Now they realize that this first step, escalation, is not leading anywhere. So now they are switching to de-escalate. So I suspect that was kind of the what was on the Ratcliffe plate. Talk about Middle East, talk about not going full kind of blown attack and so on.
And do you think that Radcliffe came back with anything?
I think it did because, as I said, that it's probably in kind of in Putin's interest, A, to have good relationship with the United States. After all, it's the most powerful country in the world, and it's probably the war is not very very popular, and of course he probably can escalate it very seriously and make it so violent that Russia will rise as a country and crush Ukraine, but this is very drastic. So he probably would rather sort of have this Donbass and Lugansk and all these territories and agreement from Ukraine that they have election and they are not going to join NATO, and he'll be happy to settle.
Yeah, he
So that's
would, wouldn't he? I think he would. And it just seems incredible to me why they don't right now just draw a line and finish this. I mean, we've already seen millions of people dying. Talking of which, with the Iran war, I mean, back in Vietnam, the American campuses were alive with anti-war protesters, all sorts of things. And what's the mood? Because you're in the middle of it there. What's the mood with Trump? Having campaigned to into power on a stop World War III, I'm going to stop the Ukraine conflict in a day, and that actually what he's done is he's launched an illegal war of aggression, which is the biggest crime anybody can ever commit on this planet at the moment, against Iran. What's the mood there? Because he's got his midterms coming up. The Republicans might not be very happy with him in November.
I mean, it's a very fascinating question. Remains to be seen. First of all, we all know that campuses are more primarily, liberal and democratic, and they don't like him to begin with, the students. And there were, a series of protests connected with the Israeli, bombing of Gaza and so on. It was kind of stopped. It turns out, and that's just kind of, for many people, it's sort of, it's a. Been new, big news, but in fact, it's a very serious reality that United States government is very heavily involved in all function of private universities. They give them unbelievable amount of money. So, this simplistic division that everything in Soviet Union is government control and everything in the West is controlled by some kind of, corporation or private people, it's actually false. So, when Trump said, you guys are protesting too much and I'm not going to give you money for medical research, engineering research, research, or, all of a sudden universities began to stop. There is no, no possibility to conduct research, no possibility to do anything. So universities nowadays are not like they were during the Vietnam War. They really depend on the government, and they were trying to walk this very thin line while probably part of the administration and, professors probably would want to protest. They also know that it can lead, with Trump to withdrawal of a lot of money. So I don't know. It remains to be seen. They also, I suspect, a lot of people are really waiting for midterm election, and they hope, maybe if Trump kind of continues to, have, power in terms of presentation in Congress, maybe protests increase. But they probably hope that through, election from votes, Democrats will be able to wrestle the power, and then there will be kind of he'll be neutered, and there'll be less need to protest. So I don't expect any big protests, at least until the midterm elections.
Finally, a sort of curveball question for you, Vladimir, which is, I wonder, do you see spiritual dimensions to these conflicts in the Middle East and in Ukraine?
Well, I think they probably have not so much spiritual dimension, but I would say maybe a dimension of kind of na national cultural identity. Of course, these things of identity are kind of shifting, but Russians get used to kind of view themselves as some kind of a, kind of center of orthodoxy, of their own particular way of living, and fighting against kind of encroaching West. So this kind of again interference of NATO and Nuland and everybody else coming to Ukraine and interfering, it's kind of maybe triggers this kind of aspect of Russian identity. We're unique. We fight the West, be it different form of Christianity, West is sympathetic to other religions as not as much as we do, and so on. So that's for Russians, it's their question of identity. For Ukrainians, it's obviously their question of identity. They like to view themselves as independent. They view themselves as independent from Poland, under which they lived for a long time. View independent of Russia. And they sort of, when Russia invaded, they were triggered in their own quest of independence. United States, probably their identities, they get used to Pax Americana. And it's very, very difficult to give up on this notion and recognize that there are China, Russia, complicated issues. They get used to war, whatever they want. They overthrow governments. They do this, they do that. They establish their puppets. All of a sudden, they see the limits to themselves. But, United States get used to the idea we're the greatest, we're the best, we know what to do. So they're a challenging question. So all these issues are kind of put there. The same applies, obviously, to Iranians. So this is triggering kind of national identity and making people dig their heels and go into some kind of national narratives, be it Israel, be it sort of Palestinians, and all sort of trying to get going. Of course, a murder is a murder, and they have to be stopped. That's a different story.
Whereabouts can people find your work? I don't know if you've got books and things like that, if people are interested in following Vladimir.
What books people would be interested?
Yeah, if you've got any of your own books, your own websites, or books you'd like to recommend.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a very good question. My book, actually, I think it's a of course it's my book, my baby, a recent book. It's called Fathers and Children, Turgenev's Theme in Russian Literature and Culture, where I basically kind of use literary texts from Turgenev to Dostoevsky to Russian films like Eisenstein films to understand Russian kind of fixation on a political father figure. The Russians like to have these big, big, important kind of rulers, father figures, be it Peter the Great or Stalin, and now they're trying to get together around Putin. Somehow the father figures which lead them in the battle. And that's supposed to be a very powerful stereotype, and it's very functioning, still continues to function, and it kind of influences the films and art, like Eisenstein, who started with socialist revolutionary films called Battleship Potemkin or Strike about masses. Ends up doing two of his last films, Alexander Nevsky and Ivan the Terrible, these two father figures leaders. And kind of almost, he wasn't like just serving the whims of Stalin. He was actually channeling, Russian dream of a good tsar, good leader, and so on. So that's all I study in my book. It just came out last year. Definitely, it will explain a lot of what many foreigners will find unexpected and unusual about Russia, in my
Yeah,
view.
because I mean, I'm very disappointed in the lack of really in our mass media anything to do with Russian culture. I mean, when I visited the country in 2014, I found it absolutely bursting with ideas, creativity. From a Russian point of view, many of them I've spoken to recently are saying, "Well, you're at it again, aren't you?" Citing the invasion by Napoleon, the invasion by Adolf Hitler, and part of this is characterizing the Ukrainian Azov battalion, etc., as Nazis. So I wonder, finally, could you just say something about whether you think that this really is justified from the Russian point of view?
Yeah, well, Russians are, they are not very happy with what Ukrainians are doing by resurrecting. The problem is, of course, every country has their own kind of grim past, be it Germany, Austria, Russia itself, with Stalin. But basically, most of the countries, or Spain and Franco, but they don't, build monuments to these past tyrants, to past murderers. There's like, Russians, some Russian bus driver can have a picture of Stalin in his, window, but that's about it. While Ukrainians, all of a sudden, they well-established criminals, people who butchered an endless amount of Poles and Jews and Russians, all of a sudden they are pronounced heroes. Can you imagine, like, Austrians are just starting celebrating Hitler and so on. So Russians, found it very unappealing, and it was part of their kind of discourse, where they basically said that's why we have to fight. But obviously there are other reasons, like NATO sort of approaching and so on. But I think what is interesting, what you said about lack of information about Russia, that's a paradox of recent times. You remember this German term, Putin Versteher. In other words, they mock people who try to understand Russia. And this is kind of very silly. We have to understand what every culture is coming from if we want to deal with it. Because otherwise you can walk into totally unexpected territory. Everybody in the United States and the Obama's establishment, they kind of knew anxiety and nervousness in Iran, that people, not all Iranians, were happy and behind their government. So they thought it's going to be a walk in the park. We'll kill the leader and we'll take over. Well, turns out it didn't happen. Why? Because they obviously didn't really know, or didn't want to know, or ignored people who know, and mocked people who know, who was telling them Iran is not that simple. You cannot just, overturn it. It's a culture also, with these traditions, with this kind of respect for authority, with this anger at the interfering foreigners could keep on, installing governments. So I think you have to know and you have to understand. But I think it was a very deliberate solution recently, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that this country is not that powerful, so we don't even want to understand them. And that was very disturbing.
It was. And I mean, you could make an analogy with people like Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler, who didn't really want to understand Jewish culture at all in the 1930s. And look where that led us. Anyway, Vladimir Goldstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony, and all the best to your listeners.